And now, from the gleaming spires of Chicago, broadcasting to Niflheim, Svartalfheim, Olympus, throughout the nine worlds and beyond, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. You are tuned to the immortal sounds of Radio Free Asgard.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 129, coming to you from beautiful Chicago, Illinois. We're a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. My name is Tom Harris, and welcome along to the show. Perhaps coming to a C2E2 near you. I'm going to kind of throw that out there because it may be happening, folks. Anyway, this episode we are going to be talking about Thor 2: The Dark World. No comics talk this time. We're just going to be talking about the movie. Now, if you haven't seen Thor 2: The Dark World and are planning on seeing it and you don't want things spoiled for you, then I would recommend that you turn this off, go listen to something else, come back once you've seen Thor 2 and, you know, not have it spoiled for you, because we're going to be giving away all the story details and so forth, and I don't want anybody having it ruined for them. Don't say you haven't been warned now, folks, because now we're going to go in and talk about the movie. So before we start talking specifics, before we start looking at the plot, looking at the characters, looking at the acting, looking at the special effects, before we do any of that, I'm going to just kind of give my very brief impressions of Thor 2. I thought Thor: The Dark World was a crackin' good film. It wasn't Citizen Kane. That's not why you go see a Marvel film. You go to see a Marvel film for the spectacle. You go to see it for the effects. You get to see it for the fisticuffs. You go to see it for any number of reasons that have nothing to do with the mechanics of plot or, you know, great performances and so forth. On that level, I think Thor 2 was a great film. It's a lot of fun. It's definitely a film that I would recommend for others to see. I do think that by and large, it's suitable for all ages. I didn't see a whole lot in there that wasn't suitable for kids. And I found that as a summer blockbuster, or I guess in this case, kind of an autumn blockbuster, it really filled the bill. It's everything that I expected it to be. It's everything that I wanted it to be. That's not to say that there aren't problems with the film. We'll talk about that a little bit more at length. And it's easy to remember when we're picking apart this movie that it might seem as though I hated it. I didn't hate it. I really like Thor 2. I actually like it in most ways better than the first one. So just kind of keep that in mind. You know, we don't pick it apart because we hate it. We pick it apart because we love it. Okay, so that's what I have to say about that. That's my disclaimer for this review. So let's start off with sort of a brief summary of the plot of Thor 2. We'll just hit all the major plot points. Thor 2 takes place roughly 2 years after the events that take place in the first film, which I find really interesting because that's almost a real time sort of time span here going on between the first and the second movie. It does make for some interesting dynamics within the film itself. We have the cast of Thor 1, the Earth-based cast, Jane Foster, Darcy, Dr. Selvig, who are not adjusting particularly well to the events of Thor 1 and the subsequent events of the Avengers film in Dr. Selvig's case. We have Dr. Selvig, who has been possessed by Loki, essentially, and has kind of lost his mind. We see him, you know, being institutionalized. We see that he's having a rough time adjusting to reality following the events of the Avengers. I like these continuity touches because it makes it seem as though the Marvel Cinematic Universe, at least those that surround the Avengers, have common touch points. I think this is a good decision. I think that that's something that Marvel should continue doing as they continue to crank these movies out, is have these tie-ins, have these things follow logically off of each other. It wouldn't have made much sense if Dr. Selvig was completely unaffected by what went on to him in the Avengers movie. So we definitely have something interesting going on from the very beginning. We have the character of Jane Foster, of course. She's devoted her research to looking for Thor, recontacting Asgard, and maybe being reunited with Thor at last. This doesn't make sense for a number of reasons that we'll talk about a little bit later. Jane makes a few attempts to try to reestablish contact with Asgard, but just can't quite manage to do it. Though you definitely see that she's on the right track. If only she were Odin, or she was possessed of this Asgardian science magic, she would be able to actually do it herself, which admittedly is pretty impressive for somebody with as thin an apparent resume as Jane has. Now, if you folks remember, a few episodes ago, we covered the two-part Thor the Dark World prelude series that Marvel put out as sort of a marketing ploy, and the events of that miniseries are echoed here. They really don't go into a lot of detail, and of course, neither did that two-part series, but pretty much everything that you have in there is going on at the beginning of Thor 2. Like I said, you really didn't need that. That was just something that give people a taste of what was coming in the Dark World. We have the continuation of that theme. We have the Bifrost, or sorry, we have to pronounce it properly because Robert is listening, Bifrost. And we have that, the portals to the various worlds now being reopened. We have Asgard reconnecting to the rest of the nine worlds. This is something that started in that two-part mini, but of course it comes to its conclusion here. Now we have Asgard re-engaging with the universe and trying to quell some of the unrest that's taken place during the time when the Bifrost wasn't working properly. Now we also get a little bit of background here where we have the introduction of the dark elf Malekith. Malekith fought a war against Odin's father, Bor. Using a weapon known only as the Aether, he almost managed to conquer everything before being defeated by the Asgardians. The Asgardians locked this weapon, the Aether, inside the stone pillar and defeated Malekith. Malekith goes into suspended animation, and that's kind of it until the Aether is reawakened by the turmoil that went on and is broken free from its container, I guess you could say. At the same time as all this, as though to make it even worse, we have this event going on called the Convergence, which is where all of the nine worlds line up or something. If you remember back in the 80s, there was this thing called the Harmonic Convergence that was this hippie new agey thing that was supposed to happen where all the planets were supposed to be in a straight line on the one side of the sun, and the noon on a particular day, people were supposed to be able to fly. It was extremely silly back then, and nobody bought it back then either. You have the worlds lining up, and therefore the distance between the worlds is the smallest at this point. Portals are opening up and all the different planets and things are going through. It leads to kind of a cool fight scene later on, but to me, it almost seems as though it's a plot device. It's not written particularly well. And other than that really cool fight scene towards the end of the movie, there's not a lot of point to it. I mean, they could have had just as strong a story, if not stronger a story, mind you, if they hadn't had this whole dimensional portal thing going on. On the other hand, it does make it easier to travel between worlds. Here we can have Thor coming back to Earth. Jane finds out that Thor has been back to Earth through the events of the Avengers movie. We are reconnected with Jane Foster. She realizes that Thor has come back, but that he didn't come to see her. Now, those of us who saw the Avengers movie know that Thor had very good reason for not having time to go sneak off and visit Jane, because he was there to capture Loki, take repossession of the Tesseract, which he needed to take back to Asgard in order to fix the Bifrost, and therefore make it possible to travel between worlds again. So basically, he doesn't see Jane, but his whole mission is going to make it easier for him to come back at a later time to see her. So it just makes Jane seem all the more self-absorbed as a result. She's so self-absorbed that she can't see beyond the nose of her face. It's a consistent character trait for the character, but it made me like Jane Foster a lot less, especially in the second movie. So as Jane is playing around with all these portals, she gets separated from the others, and she ends up being teleported to the planet where the ether is being kept in this pillar. Because of all the problems, this pillar's been damaged and the ether sort of leaks out and possesses Jane. Well, of course it does. I mean, how else do you keep Jane involved in the story for this point? Now, the problem, of course, with the ether escaping is that that wakes up Malekith. And Malekith can track the ether in some ill-defined way and decides he needs to go capture the ether again and once again continue on with his conquest of the entire universe or the destruction of the entire universe. We're really not made entirely sure which, but, you know, if he were going to destroy the entire universe, that would be pretty dumb. Sort of in the middle of all this, Jane and Thor are reunited. Thor comes back, finds Jane. And in the course of all this, Jane exhibits some, how you say, unearthly abilities. Thor, of course, realizes, hey, something peculiar is going on here. No fool he. And Thor takes Jane off to Asgard to be cured. This is kind of interesting because here we have Thor taking Jane to Asgard, which is something that didn't happen in the comics until, you know, several years along. The healers of Asgard are unable to figure out what's going on, but Odin recognizes the ether. He realizes that this is a very dangerous situation, that Jane's human body is not going to be able to hold the ether for long. And he also realizes, of course, being the Allfather, that Malekith is going to be looking for this. So Jane is kept in Asgard for her own protection. During the course of this, when Malekith finds out that she's in Asgard, he attacks using his armies and, of course, using Curse. Now, Curse in the comics was a character that was changed against his will and therefore held it against Malekith. And actually, in the end, didn't he kill Malekith? I think he did. But in the movie, you see that Algrim more or less volunteers for this duty to become this monster. And they have this weird sort of crystal thing that they use to change. So during the battle, of course, or where Malekith is trying to capture Jane and therefore the ether, the goddess Frigg is killed. We'll talk about that a little bit later. I don't have a major problem with this as part of the story, but it's notable. Frigg's sacrifice allows for the Asgardians to gain the upper hand, and Malekith is driven away. Obviously, the death of Frigga creates a lot of problems among the family. Thor is out for revenge, and he turns to the one person who possibly loved Frigga as much as he did, other than Odin, who forbids him to do anything. He turns to Loki. Ever since Thor brought the Tesseract and Loki back to Asgard, Loki's been kept in a sort of a plexiglass cell in the basement of Asgard, for lack of a better term. And Thor and Loki team up to go and defeat Malekith. The plan that they come up with, of course, is to use Jane as bait. They reckon that Malekith wants the ether so badly that he's going to follow Jane wherever she goes, no matter where in the universe she goes. Because the doctors in Asgard don't have any way of knowing how to get the ether out of Jane, they're relying on Malekith's knowledge of the ether to be able to remove it from Jane, leaving her alive. The only problem with that is that risks the ether falling into Malekith's hands and giving him exactly what he wants. The upside of that is that when the ether is outside of Jane's body, but before Malekith can take control of it, that leaves a vulnerable spot where they can attack the ether and possibly destroy it. During the course of this, the Dark Elves, when they were attacking Asgard, they had a ship crash in the middle of the palace. Thor and Loki commandeer that spacecraft. They go taking off and they go flying off to Svartalfheim with Jane Foster in tow. Their plan partially works in that they're able to lure Malekith to Svartalfheim. Malekith draws the ether out of Jane, but Thor fails to destroy it. This is kind of a problem because the ether then flows into Malekith. Malekith is now all-powerful and he goes flying off. Loki is apparently mortally wounded and apparently dies in Thor's arms. So after this battle in which Loki apparently dies, Thor and Jane find another portal, just by happenstance, and are able to get back to Earth. They find out that Malekith is planning to destroy the entire universe, and that in order to do this for some reason, he has to go to Greenwich, which makes absolutely no sense. It's obviously a significant spot in the UK. It's the prime meridian, Greenwich Mean Time, all that crap. I suppose it's notable for that point, but why Greenwich? It would make absolutely no sense whatsoever. Why not Norway? Why not Stonehenge? Why not something a little bit more ancient and cool than Greenwich Palace? You know, that didn't make any sense to me. Malekith comes to Earth. There's a big battle. There's lots of portals opening up all over the place because the convergence is at its height. We have some really cool scenes, especially with Thor's hammer, you know, because, you know, Thor's hurling his hammer. It's going through these invisible portals and everything's flying around and it's all chaotic and cool. That was kind of the one of the coolest things about the whole movie. I liked the fact that even though you really didn't need this whole portal thing to make this a good movie, it shows off the 3D effects to good measure. You know, it really shows off the 3D effects well. You have the, you know, hammer flying all around. You have, you know, the people going in and out of all these spectacular worlds. And I have to say, the worlds were very well realized. You have, you know, creatures from Asgard and from Jotunheim and from, you know, everything else coming to Earth. You've got kind of this weird mixture of things going on. In the midst of all this chaos, and we have people coming and going and people being transported to all sorts of different worlds, Malekith manages to more or less get away. It's up to Thor to find Malekith. They have to lure him back to Svartalfheim, and that is kind of the idea. They'll lure him back to Svartalfheim and destroy him there. They do this through the use of the sort of Kirby machines that Jane Foster's been working on. They have this, I guess they're designed to stabilize the portals and make it a little bit more predictable. In that way, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. It's a very Star Trekian sort of solution, but they manage to do it. They lure Malekith back to Svartalfheim and they destroy him before he can destroy everything else. We then kind of get a little denouement where Thor goes back to Asgard and talks to Odin. Odin talks about how noble Thor is and how proud he is of him. Thor gives Loki his fair due. Remember, he thinks that Loki's dead. He thinks that Loki died fighting Malekith. And we then kind of have Thor refusing the throne, going back to Earth. And, of course, our last shot of the main part of the movie, we find out that Odin is actually Loki. He's still alive. And that was really kind of where we end it. Now, we have two post-credit scenes here, the first of which involves Volstagg and Sif. They visit a being known as the Collector. Now, those of us who have been reading Marvel Comics for a long time, we know who the Collector is. He collects things. He collects people. He collects whatever he can get his hands on. In some weird way, he kind of sums up the whole geek aesthetic. And because Odin has managed to, I guess, recapsulize the ether into one compact package, they entrust it for some reason to the Collector. Reason being is that the Tesseract, the cosmic cube from the Avengers and also, you know, from the first Thor movie, is being held in Asgard and having, as they say, two Infinity Stones too near each other makes it very, very dangerous for both of them to remain in Asgard. Why they would pick a disreputable character like the Collector to take control of the ether? Well, think about it. Who did we see in the very last scene in the main movie? If Loki is disguised as Odin, he can certainly be working against the interests of the heroes again. Now, of course, that also raises another question here, and that what's happened to Odin? And I suppose we'll find that out in Thor 3. After Sif and Volstagg leave, we have a comment from the Collector to the effect of, that's one down, five to go. So here it looks like the Collector may be trying to get his hands on the rest of the Infinity Stones, aka Soul Gems, whatever the hell they're calling them now. Back in my day, they were called Soul Gems, which I guess just kind of shows my age. And I didn't read any of that Thanos Infinity Watch stuff. Now, this particular plot thread is going to be carried on in the next Marvel movie, Guardians of the Galaxy. And that's the idea of having the Collector here. I did notice that this particular post-credit scene has a very different look from the rest of the movie. And I do believe that this is tied in with the fact that Guardians of the Galaxy visually is going to be very, very different from anything that we've seen from the other Marvel movies so far. It looked really campy and colorful, and I don't know, it looked interesting. So, you know, definitely going to be interested in checking out the Guardians of the Galaxy when it does come out, even if it does have Rocket Raccoon in it. Now, the second post-credit scene bothers me a little bit, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. We have a scene where Jane is alone in her apartment and still mooning over Thor, and then you see a flash of light on her balcony, and we have the, you know, the Bifrost coming down and dropping Thor off, and they smooch, and everybody's happy. Now, I have a very mixed feelings about this scene, and I'm definitely going to come down on the side of did not like. It was completely unnecessary. So now that we've gone over the plot a little bit, I want to compartmentalize the film a bit and talk about different aspects of what I think the strengths and weaknesses of the film are. The first strength that I want to talk about is design and the overall look of the film. I think this is a place where this movie really, really excels. I would go so far as to say, this is the best thing about Thor 2. The locations in the UK and in Iceland, you have some absolutely spectacular scenery. It's mythic in scope, and that's what it needed to be. I think if you go back to my old episode number 5, where I talked about the first Thor movie, I talked about how in the second installment, I would like to see more of Asgard and see more of Thor's environment. And that's exactly what we got in this movie. And I think that the movie is better off for it. Now, one of the things that I've always thought about Thor as a character is that he works much better in this mythic environment than he does on Earth. He always seems a little bit oddly off kilter in the comics when he's having these superhero adventures on Earth, as opposed to when he's in Asgard among his own kind. It's not always true. There's some great stories that take place on Earth, don't get me wrong. But I think that just this character works better in this kind of environment. So that being said, I just wanted to make a few comments on the way the characters are portrayed. Now, as you know, the movieverse should not be considered to be, you know, canonical as far as I'm concerned, except in the confines of its own universe. So take this with a grain of salt, of course. Like I was saying, I think Thor works best in this mythical format, but the truer you are to the myths, the less fleshed out Thor is. Thor himself seemed oddly flat in this movie. He didn't have a lot of emotional depth at all. He's great on the gangbusters, smash bang stuff, but not so much on the emotional stuff. I don't know if this is just Chris Hemsworth being directed that way. I don't know if this is a limitation of the script. I'm not really sure what it is, but he was oddly flat throughout the movie. Jane Foster, like I said, comes across as incredibly self-absorbed. And like I said, I don't really care for what I saw. We've already talked about that. Darcy and Ian, they're the comedy relief. And I'm okay with the intern and her slightly less intelligent, less talented intern. And they have some cute scenes together, especially the scene in the warehouse where they're dropping things through the portal and he loses the car keys. He got them back later. Don't worry. But it was still, you know, there was some cute, funny stuff in there. Dr. Selvig, really kind of an interesting role because this is leading right out of the Avengers where he had a supporting role. It shows how he was affected by the events of that film. We get Stan's cameo in the old folks home where, or the, I guess you could call it a rehabilitation center, or I don't know what do you call it anyway. But Dr. Selvig is there and he's still kind of a little bit nuts. And when they do eventually get him out, he proves key to helping kind of solve some of the scientific problems in the movie. Made it for an interesting story arc for that character within the confines of this film. I definitely hope that we see more of him in future installments. We also have the characters in Asgard. We'll talk about the death of Frigga here really briefly because I liked Renee Russo as Frigga. She brought an interesting sort of motherly quality to the character, which is kind of exactly what you need from Frigga. I'm a little bit disappointed that they killed her off, and particularly because it seemed like kind of a senseless, cheap death. Maybe this was the catalyst that they needed to get Thor and Loki to team up. Yeah, I guess it would be. I mean, they couldn't exactly kill off Odin now, could they? Or did they? But at the same time, to kill Frigga, I mean, that's kind of a big step, isn't it? Though, you know what, it's the comics and it's mythology and anything can happen ultimately. I do like Renee Russo as Frigga, and especially when she was being a badass, I thought it was pretty darn cool. I mean, a warrior queen should be able to fight. And I think that that's something that they handled pretty well as far as this movie was concerned. The funeral scene was oddly flat as well. I was thinking probably the whole time, they just killed off a character in mythology. And not really thinking about the resonance in the story. And that's really because there's only one character for which there seems to be an emotional resonance. That is Loki. Now, for you fans of Renee Russo as Frigga, well, there's still hope to see her again. After all, in Norse mythology, when a character dies in battle, they go to Valhalla. Valhalla is part of Asgard. This is Odin's great hall. This is a place where the fallen heroes go. They can kind of go visit Frigga whenever they want to. And of course, there's precedence for that in the comics. I mean, Hera died in his very first appearance. and they've shown him dozens of times since then. He's been dead for most of his career at Marvel. So Thor 2 sees a slightly different sort of role for Loki in the story. We can't really have him as the big bad villain in this movie. And the reason why is because we just had him as the big bad villain in The Avengers, and we had him as the big bad villain in Thor. Here we have to have Loki kind of working on the sides of the gods. That's consistent with the way that Loki was treated in Norse mythology. He wasn't as evil in Norse mythology as he was in the comics. We've talked about that on the show before. But here we actually have him working side by side with Thor. Certainly he's still pursuing his own agenda. His feelings towards Frigga certainly seem for the most part to be genuine. And I think that that's really sold by Tom Hiddleston, who steals the show as Loki, just as he did in The Avengers. He's an amazingly talented actor, probably, even including Anthony Hopkins, the most talented actor in the cast. Now, unfortunately, this has led to sort of a cult of personality surrounding Loki. We have Tom Hiddleston, who is an amazing talent, and he's not hard to look at either. That means that we have a very strong female built-in audience for the character of Loki. Now, when Pete and I saw the movie, Pete didn't really care for Thor 2. He didn't particularly like Thor 1 either, for that matter. But this is one of the problems that he has with Loki, is that Loki has fangirls. And to me, that doesn't affect the movie because this is something that takes place in the fandom. It's not something that takes place in the story. But this movie definitely had more of an emphasis on the characters that the girls swoon over. And I think we'll talk a little bit later here about the marketing of this film and how I feel that this film was marketed towards women in a way that The Avengers, Captain America, so forth were not. Let it suffice to say that I thought Loki was just a hell of a lot of fun, and I look forward to seeing him in future movies. Whereas in the comics, I kind of get a little bit bored of Loki showing up every other week, especially back during the Silver Age, though I think it's notable that he hasn't yet appeared in Thor: God of Thunder, at least where I left off in my coverage. Now, for this next little bit, we're going to talk about Odin. And what I'm going to do first, before we go on to my own commentary, I'm going to read out some commentary that was left on the Radio Free Asgard Facebook group. And this was left by Christopher Bendorf, who is a longtime member of our group. He talks about more than just Odin, but that's kind of the focus. I'm just going to read out what he said. So Christopher's saying, "I love Thor: The Dark World. It's better than the first one by a mile. And really, the first one wasn't bad either." Oh, I agree with that. I don't think the first one was bad at all. "Love the fact that we got to see more Thor in action, as Thor was depowered for most of the first movie. We also got more of Asgard, and that's a big plus. The very first day I saw the movie, I said that I had a pet peeve with the movie, but I didn't want to spoil it until everyone on the board had seen it. The one gripe I have is the handling of Odin. Anthony Hopkins is a great actor, and he's doing a great job here too. But I do think that the Odin he's delivering is out of character and far removed from the comic source material." Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. "Number one, we are not gods. Wow, I hated this line. Odin would never say that. No, the Asgardians are gods, and Odin has always relished in the fact that they have worshippers on Earth. He's the all-father of the gods in Asgard. As simple as that. Asgard isn't Krypton. It's the home of the pantheon of Norse gods. End of story. Two, someone told Hopkins to play Odin as a sickly old man who can't wait to retire and hand over the crown to his son and go fishing. They really downplayed the power of Odin, the Odin force, and I didn't like this at all. Other than that, though, I thought the movie was great, and I can't wait to see what's coming next." So thanks, Christopher, for that. And yeah, we're going to talk here about Odin for just a moment. Now, my thoughts on Odin mirror yours in a few ways. Now, my thought about Odin in this movie is that he just didn't have a lot to do. I'm going to disagree with you slightly in that, you know, I think Anthony Hopkins is a great actor. This was not a great performance. I don't know if this is due to the direction. I don't know if it's due to the script. It seemed to me as though he really phoned in his performance. If I had to make a guess, I would guess that he didn't really want to be there, but had to be for contractual reasons. Basically, in this movie, he's just window dressing. He really doesn't do a lot other than try to help Jane and then fail. You don't really see Odin in battle, which is something that, to me, I mean, Odin's a war god. We've talked about this in the past, that Odin is somebody who relishes battle. So why wasn't he mixing it up along with everybody else? Now, I have my own hypothesis about why he is portrayed in this way, but we have to keep in mind, too, that the Marvel movie universe is not the same as the Marvel universe, which is not the same as the mythology universe or the world of the Norse lore. It's just not the same. Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed myself with the portrayal of Odin here. So let's just talk a moment about Malekith. Now, this is obviously one of the major points of difference between the comics universe and the movie universe. The Malekith in the comics is nothing like the character we got here in Thor 2. That's okay. I do recognize that the movie universe is not the comics universe. It's not the same thing. I kind of try to take the Marvel movie universe as being its own thing. The internal rules of the movieverse, as long as they're consistent, are just fine with me. It's like the Earth 2 of Thor. You know, whatever happens on that world is fine as long as it's consistent with the other stuff that happens on that world. That being said, I think that Malekith is a wasted character here. They could have had this villain be anybody. I'm glad that they made it Malekith. I hope that Walt Simonson got some coin for this. But at the same time, anybody could have played that character. Why get an actor with the talent of Christopher Eccleston, who I think is a great actor, and have him play what's essentially a two-note character? It just seemed a bit odd to me. This is one of the things about Thor 2 that bothered me a little bit. I was chuffed about the idea of having Malekith in the movie, and I guess I wasn't horribly disappointed by it, but like I said, he could have been played by anybody. The Warriors 3 and Sif, pretty much wasted here. They didn't really have all that much to do. I mentioned that before. Sif in particular, you know, I like the character of Sif in the Warriors 3. I like the interplay between them. I like the fact that Thor has this great supporting cast. Again, I don't think that they were handled particularly well. They basically wrote out Hogan at the beginning of the movie, and then we see him at the very end when the big battle is going on and there's a few of these portals opening up in Vanaheim. We do see a little bit more of Fandral and Volstagg, but not all that much. We do have some neat stuff in the beginning of the movie where we have a battle going on one of the Earths. Now, as I alluded to last time, there's one character that's notable by his absence, and that is Baldur. Baldur is too important a character to the Thor mythos not to be in Thor 2. And it's a little bit puzzling that throughout the first two movies, he's not even given so much as a mention. I mean, we have Tyr appear, albeit very briefly here, but Baldur, who arguably is like something like the fourth most important of the Norse gods, not actually appearing in either Thor 1 or 2 and not even being mentioned, it's inexcusable, like I said last episode. I think it's notable, though, that we need to mention it. I'm hoping that in Thor 3, because there will be a Thor 3, I'm hoping that Baldur will emerge and play an important part of the story. I don't think that the Thor cinematic universe is complete without the character. Okay, so for this last little section of the show, I want to talk a little bit about the marketing aspect of this. How Marvel sold this movie to me and to other people. I think that this is a really interesting thing. One of the things that Pete pointed out to me, Pete's my other half, and I've mentioned him on the show before, but Pete went to go see this with me. Pete didn't enjoy Thor 2. For that matter, Pete didn't really enjoy Thor 1. He's just not really a big fan of the character. There's a lot of other characters that he is into, but Thor is not really one of them. Now, one of the points that Pete brought up that I found was particularly interesting, not saying I agree with it, but I don't entirely disagree with it either, is that he seemed to think that the marketing of Thor was geared towards women. Now, I kind of understand why he thinks that. Obviously, we have Chris Hemsworth, who's a very good-looking guy. We have Tom Hiddleston, who's a very good-looking guy. The two of them are playing brothers. There are scenes in this movie that are almost slashy. It's sort of tailor-made for the fangirl audience to come in and write their fanfics and to moon over the hot guys. Also, at the center of Thor, you have this relationship story. That's something you're not going to find in Captain America or Iron Man. You've got this character of Jane Foster, who is obsessed with tracking down the love of her life. You know, the mysterious guy who came and she hit with her car and then he left again. I can understand how this franchise, more than any of the other Marvel franchises, would appeal to women. I definitely get that. Is that really what Marvel had in mind? I don't know. You know, I think it's good when Marvel tries to draw different aspects of their audience in. You can't have all comic book movies being marketed to, you know, 8 to 10 year old boys. in the male-dominated comic book movie world, I think it's actually a little bit refreshing to have something in there that's not geared towards the action movie fan, that we actually do have a little bit of romance. Now, I kind of wish that it wasn't the romance that we have. Pete compares the romance of Jane Foster and Thor, rather unfavorably, I might add, to the romance in Twilight. I will hasten to add that he and I do not agree on this. He compares the character of Jane Foster with the character of Belle. Now, I will say that I have limited experience with Twilight. I did see the first film, and what I saw did not impress me. But as Pete explains it, Belle is kind of a cipher in Twilight. She's a character that's like a cardboard cutout with no face on it. The only picture that you have of Belle is the image that you project onto it. That's to encourage the, you know, young female reader of Twilight to put herself in the place of Belle. We really don't have that in Thor. We have too strong of a character in Jane Foster, though I would argue that, you know, the character is not as strong as she should be. But I don't think that we quite have that same level of projection that you would be putting on as a viewer or as a reader onto Jane Foster that you would have being put onto Belle. I do think that, you know, after watching the movie, I kind of wonder to myself, what the hell does Thor see in her? I don't think that, you know, she's that wonderful of a character. But at the same time, I don't see her as being the sort of blank slate the way, you know, Belle is in Twilight. And I'll be perfectly honest here. I think I would prefer a blank slate to the really insipid and stupid Jane Foster that we got in the Lee Kirby era. Okay, so we've been yammering on about this movie for the last little while now. Once again, folks, thanks very much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Just because the review show is over doesn't mean that our discussion has to be. You can always send us an email. You can leave us a Facebook comment. The email address is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. And of course, if you come onto Facebook, you can search for Radio Free Asgard there, and you will definitely find us. And I will definitely add you to the group if you request it. And you can send us commentary in either one of those places. And I will, of course, read it out on the show. So, from Tom Harris in beautiful Chicago, Illinois, thanks very much for listening. And we'll see you next week here on Radio Free Asgard. Radio Free Asgard is copyright Tom Harris USA Productions, which is totally responsible for its content. The Mighty Thor and all related characters are copyright Marvel Comics. And the other characters that appear on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders. We don't own any of this as much as we'd like to. The stories covered on this podcast are for entertainment, educational, and review purposes only. If you like what you've heard on today's program, please tell your friends, drop an iTunes review, or join our Facebook group. Music from Eden, the Invincible Sword of the Elfsmith, is copyright Mott's Vent and is used with permission because Mott's is simply awesome. Radio Free Asgard should not be downloaded while pregnant, nursing, or operating heavy machinery, and we are not responsible for any damages incurred as the result of this misuse. Side effects may include being lost in a cave and finding a magical hammer, and falling in love with Jane Foster. Once again, thank you for listening to Radio Free Asgard.